So that was kind of like my introduction into Kensington. And from there, it just, I say from there, it went downhill. It already was downhill. But even as I am like telling the story, I'm like, it wasn't that bad yet. It was bad, but like it got worse. So when I was in Kensington, I think I just told my family, like, I'm moving to the city. I was very like disconnected from them. I was also an adult, so they weren't like, well, you have to come home or else, right? I was at a point in my life where I was kind of just like alienated from them. And
And like with this could be a point where like this was my bottom, right? But this is when they talk about like you can dig it a little
Oh,
deeper,
and I
like,
dug. Yeah. I thought it was thrilling down there. So I got to know more of like the street lifestyle. I don't know how else to like describe that, but I wasn't homeless yet, right? I was living with somebody in an apartment, but in the inner city of Kensington, Philadelphia, that I would just go out on the street and meet all sorts of different people. I eventually burned bridges with the person that I was staying with. And I, at the time, was like, well, I can just like continue to find people who will let me stay with them. At some point, I started doing other drugs, right? So I was addicted to heroin. And then somebody introduced me to crack cocaine. And I remember the first time I did it, I was like, knew that I was immediately addicted. Like the person that introduced me to that, the moment I took a hit, I was like, I never should have done that because now I'm going to be horribly addicted to this. So I was doing both, right? So kind of staying out all night, staying up all night, then doing more heroin. It went back and forth. So my addiction got bad between cocaine and heroin. When I was out there, I met other women, right, who were also addicted to drugs. And when you're there and you're not working, I learned very quickly, like, well, how do you make money for drugs? All of these people were prostituting themselves, right? Of this is how you can get money to get what you want. So I started doing that. And it wasn't like, at the time, it wasn't even like, I don't think I can do this. I was like, I can do this to get what I want. It wasn't this like, have I really succumbed to having to do this? So I share that in the sense of like, my thinking was so far gone that my assumption would be most individuals would question, like, am I really going to prostitute myself to get drugs? My brain didn't question that. I was just like, I can do this to get money, to get drugs, or just to get drugs.
Because you want to reach that finish line
I
with
just,
drugs.
I
That's
needed
it.
drugs. So I was like, I will do whatever, right? So this went on for a really long time where I was no longer staying with people. It was like I was walking the streets. I was being solicited by men. I would get hotel rooms that they would pay for me to stay in, right? I was like, I can just keep doing this. Obviously, that is not like a sustainable kind of lifestyle. So eventually, you meet people that are like not nice people, right? Dangerous people that take advantage of you. Because I or any of the people out there were definitely, vulnerable individuals. But when I was in those circumstances, I didn't look at myself as a vulnerable individual. I looked at myself as like, these people are doing this to me, but like, look at the situations that I'm putting myself in. Almost this belief of like, well, I chose to expose myself to this. So like, what did I expect? Like, did I expect to be like treated well by people?
Like you deserve it almost.
I don't know if I would say deserve, but like almost in that sense of like, well, of
What
course
did you
this would
expect?
happen because look at what you're doing. Not the line of thinking of like, how could this happen to me? But more like you put yourself out here and like, this is just what it is. Like this, you have to get used to this.
You get sober when you're 29. We're somewhere between 25 and 29 right now, right? So you're close to the edge? Are you almost there?
Oh, the edge of like,
Of when you decide that I've had enough.
no. So the no. So like, there were. I think I was out there for like maybe 5 or 6 years off and on. And I say off and on because there were points over those years where I would call my family out of desperation, even though they hadn't heard from me for months, to be like, I think I need to go to treatment. But it wasn't that I wanted treatment. I just didn't want to be on the streets anymore. So there were stints when like I would convince my, it was always my dad, right? Of, I think I want to go to treatment. I want to get sober. My dad would come and pick me up. I would convince him why he needed to give me money so that I could get high to not be sick if like he wanted me to make it to that treatment center, right? So really manipulated him. Or like, I just need you to get me a hotel room for tonight and I'll go to treatment tomorrow.
So at this point, you've been prostituting, and is that considered human trafficking?
Not that I would have considered.
Okay.
So
this is now, because what I understand of it from my newfound understanding of it, because as I told you before, I thought that human trafficking was putting kids in a container and putting them on a ship,
right,
and who knows what else. But now I understand it as exploitation against someone's will.
Yeah.
So this is at your will.
This was at my will, which like, people could probably debate, like, but was that your choice? Like, did you have a choice? In my brain, yes, I did. But
you weren't doing it for someone else.
I wasn't doing it.
You didn't have to bring anything back to someone else.
Exactly.
So it was your will.
It was my will of like, I'm going to do this because I need to get something that I want. After I was doing that on my own, right, of like, I can just walk down the street, I can wait for somebody to stop, pick me up, I can go in their car. Like, it wasn't that I was working, that's what they called it, was working. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
I say that like it's normal. Prostituting yourselves on the street in Kensington, Philadelphia is what they called, is like you're out there working. So I was doing that on my own. Mm. Eventually it got into, I met this guy. This is the same guy who I think I mentioned to you guys earlier, who eventually stalked me in sobriety, was arrested. He was since deported. This guy, one time picked me up, right? So I wasn't working for like a pimp. Nobody was pimping me out for the first bit of time that I was prostituting myself. This guy, and his first name is Alan. That's just what I'll share.
Okay.
He stopped one time and I thought this was a guy that was picking me up for a date. That's what they called them, right? Of like, I was a prostitute. He stopped. I could get in his car and I could make money. That's not at all what happened. So this is kind of where like grooming, which I didn't know was grooming, started happening. This guy picked me up. I assumed, okay, like, what do you need me to do? How much money can you give me? He was like, I don't want anything from you. And that was the first time in my life out there where a guy picked me up that was like, I don't want anything from you. He was like, are you hungry? Do you need clothes? Because clearly like I was like disgusting. I was homeless. And I remember being like, what? Like, I'll do whatever you want. Like, I just need money. I need to get drugs. And he was like, no. Like, so he took me to eat, got me off of the streets. I was like the crazy homeless person that was walking the streets in like the snow, right? Because this was in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so, that's like, what I was thinking at some point.
Bad winters there.
I was like, where's your stuff?
Yeah.
Cold. So
most people who are in that position don't have master's degrees.
No.
That's what it's crazy
to me. I know.
And not only a master's degree, but like a master's degree in criminology.
Yeah.
So when he started doing this, you weren't like, well, what does he want?
I think it took me off guard because I was like, what do you mean? Like, you're just going to like buy me food, or you're going to give me the $20 or the $50 and take me to the corner to go buy the drugs, but you're not going to make me do anything sexually with you in return.
Right.
And I was like, what? So my sick brain was like, this person cares about me. This guy wants to help me. This went on for a while. And I remember every other time he'd pick me up, I was like, maybe this is the time that he's going to tell me, like, okay, you have to do this for me because I just gave you money, right? Or I just bought you the drugs. And he didn't. So this was what I didn't understand, was his way of grooming me to like make me trust him, make me believe that he cared about me, never wanted anything in return for me. What I didn't know is that this guy was like involved in a huge prostitution ring, right? That's like this underground world. But their process in building up that trust or that rapport with women on the street who were just walking the streets, prostituting themselves, right? They would target women that weren't working for somebody.
Right,
so making you think like they care about you, they want to help you, they'll get you what you need, but you don't offer them anything in return. So eventually that stopped. Eventually it was like, well, now I need you to do this or I need you to do that.
When you say eventually that stopped, this and that are sexual?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I, because I've heard you on another podcast, yeah, and I heard that you, and correct me if I'm wrong or I misheard, that it wasn't for him yet.
It wasn't for him. It was, so it wasn't with him, which again, looking back is like another tactic of like, I didn't have to do anything sexually with him. It was, I need you to go out on a date with this man, right? And then would give me whatever I wanted. What I wanted was drugs or money. So that was another tactic of like, I could still look at him as this guy is linking me to this date that then I can get what I want. So he must care about me because he's not making me do sexual things with him. Mm. So it was like this slow introduction into what I didn't realize was like, they called it the agency. It's like what they called it. And it was really this like huge prostitution ring. So I was given a cell phone, right? It wasn't my cell phone because I had no money. He would give me a cell phone that the agency controlled. So it was like, you could use that cell phone to only contact them or to like talk to these men that you had to go on dates with. They kind of like controlled all of that stuff.
In the beginning, did you have the feeling of like, oh, he's hooking me up with someone else so I can get something?
Yeah.
That's what I would think.
Yeah.
I'd be like, thanks for, you know, the reference.
Well,
so
exactly.
Say, you know?
I looked at it as like he's helping me.
Yeah.
So again, looking at this man in this light of like, he's still not making me do sexual things with him. He's protecting me because now I don't have to be on the streets by myself where people could take advantage of me, hurt me, rob me. Right. So it was
sorry. She's watching the Steelers game.
In the sick, like, yes. In the sickest way, in the sickest way possible. This actually makes it's ingenious.
Mm-hmm.
It's ingenious.
Yeah, in the worst way possible. That's so sad and scary.
It's horribly scary and very sick. But it's almost genius.
It is.
Because somebody who's of sound mind, it flips everything upside down.
Yes, and sound mind, he wasn't doing drugs. So this wasn't
somebody. Not.
So because he couldn't, right? Because he had to have sound mind to run this operation where it's like, then it turned into like, he would put drugs out for me or other women just in the morning, but you couldn't have more until you went on the date with this other person, like nearly dope sick vomiting.
Oh.
So it became a whole, like he was of sound mind orchestrating this entire operation. And in my mind,
scary.
I'm like, somebody addicted to drugs, maybe I could understand them doing this, but he was not using drugs because you can't use drugs and then orchestrate this whole business underground prostitution
for him,
operation.
Don't
for
get
him,
high on your
when
own
you're
supply.
High. Yeah.
For him, it was all money.
It was all money.
I mean, how did it transition to a point where you were like, oh, wait, they own me, is my first question.
Yeah.
And my second question is, when they would bring in newer girls, did you feel like, oh, they're doing that same thing?
To them.
I'm no longer the new kid on the block.
Yes. I think that's when I realized like, okay, this is like on a whole much larger of a scale.
Yeah.
Was when I got worse, right? I was no longer like this like attractive person. I was probably like disgustingly horribly physically appearing. Like I was not a put together person. So when I started seeing them bringing girls that were once like me of like starting out for their first time in that area, like just starting a bad addiction, but not so far gone. And like, they still looked good. They still were put together. I was like, wait, that's used to be me. So I don't think I realized until other girls were brought in where I was like, that's what's happening.
Got it.
And then things of like, if I kept money for myself or like went and bought food and that you would get like screamed at or sometimes like physically hurt for doing something like that, where they're like, no, like that's ours. Like you can't go and spend that on whatever. I think I bought like soda or chips one day and they were like, that's our money. Like, what did you do? So like, or one time this is crazy. I went and got my own date, not through them, to make money, to be like, look, like you guys didn't have to give me money this time. I made it on my own. And that was not okay. Mm. It was like, you work for me. You have to give me all of that. Like, it was things like that where I'm like, okay, this is not of my own free will. Like, I
am. And you never tried to leave?
Working for these people.
Was there ever a moment?
Not in the like, my life is in danger. I have to get out of here. Because I was so far gone and so horribly addicted to drugs that I looked at those individuals as like, if I don't have them, I have nothing.
It was a lifeline.
Or like, how could I survive out here without them? Because I wasn't like, I want to get sober. I need to get off the streets. I need to get out of this lifestyle.
Wow.
So how the hell did you get out of it?
Yeah.
So in all of those times, right, where I was like getting further into that lifestyle, further into my addiction, times when I was like out on the street, I left out this whole part. I got arrested so many different times for either solicitation prior to me being in this prostitution sex ring, when I was just on my own on the streets.
Okay.
I would get, not just me, this happened all the time, picked up by undercover cops. You don't realize they're undercover cops until like you're two blocks down the street in this guy's car, and then they stop, and then all of these police officers swarm the car and they're like, this is an undercover police officer. So I got arrested so many times for trying to solicit what I didn't know was an undercover police officer, possession, right? A lot of charges that, thank God, were misdemeanors in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And I say thank God, because in some other states, possession of heroin or prostitution are felonies. So I am a very fortunate person that although I have a past criminal history, never got a felony.
Criminal history and degree in criminology.
Yeah.
Say that 10 times fast.
Exactly.
Well, legally speaking, misdemeanors are not anything to brag about.
No.
But, you know, they're not punishable by more than a year in prison.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, like, I racked up a bunch of misdemeanors for possession, for prostitution, for solicitation. And the first time you get arrested, you don't have a record, right? You go. You're in a county jail, maybe for 24 hours. They take your fingerprints, you go. It was like, so in the beginning,
this happened to me.
Not that it was okay, right? But it's like, you got a slap on the wrist, you got released. There were probably court dates I was supposed to go to or a fine I was supposed to pay, never did that.
So the guy who was controlling you was the one who bailed you out and did this, or did you have your parents involved?
No, in the beginning it was like, you would just get released 24 to 48 hours later, and then you were given a court date to show up to, and I just wouldn't show up. So like warrants were put out for my arrest. Depending the area that I was then arrested in, maybe someone then had to bail you out. So it was whether it was him or other people that were bailing me out, never did I call my parents from jail to be like, I got arrested, because I knew that they would not help me. And I hadn't spoken to them for years.
Are we getting close to a bottom, or does it get
worse? We are getting close to like how I got out of that.
What I mean,
like, she's got the shovel in.
This is pretty bad.
It was bad. It was bad. And I'm not going to get into details of like traumas that happened to me out there, things that happened to me, things that I saw.
I just can't even imagine.
Things that I witnessed happening to other people, watching people be killed. Like there were things that like I had no business in being a part of that I saw when I was out there. But how I eventually got out, and this is where never did I think I would say this, thank God I had a record. Because if I didn't have a record, the police officer that eventually arrested me from the warrant unit was the guy that knew I was involved in like an underground prostitution ring. But you don't get out of that because they come in and save you from that. I got out of that because I had a legal record, and this officer knew that I was like involved in this organized prostitution ring. I had warrants out for my arrest, and when he picked me up, it was on a warrant. But that was him also being like, I'm getting you out of this lifestyle. So I didn't get out of that lifestyle because they like raided this prostitution ring. I got out of it because I had a criminal record that literally like removed me from that whole lifestyle.
How lucky that is.
I know, which at the time, like I remember the day that I got arrested for that because I knew that I was out. Like I knew that I was going to be in jail for at least up to a year because of outstanding records that I had. But I knew that that would keep me safe and out of that lifestyle for a certain amount of time.
Was there a sigh of relief?
There was of like, I was very scared of like, I didn't know how many outstanding warrants I had. So I was scared of like, I'm probably going to be locked up for a while. And I had been locked up prior, right? Different times. But I was like, I'm going to be in jail for like more than a couple months. So I was scared about that, but I was relieved of like, I am out of this lifestyle as long as I can stay in jail.
Did anybody tell you what you were involved in and how serious it was? Did they explain to you that you were safe there and that you didn't want to get out?
So it was a couple months. When I got arrested that time, I was probably sitting in jail for about 4 months, where unbeknownst to me, this same officer who happened to work for the FBI and Children Task Force of Philadelphia. I didn't know that. I thought he was just a warrant union officer. I thought he was an asshole of like, this guy just threw me in jail, but he was behind the scenes working to combat human sex trafficking. I didn't know that. Him and my family were working behind the scenes to get me into long-term treatment, which I didn't want. And I also didn't know that they were doing that. But when I was in there for a few months, and I remember I had a phone call with my mom who said, like, we found a treatment center for you. You're going to treatment. I had also been connected with Network of Victim Assistance. It's called NOVA, through this officer. And I remember not understanding, like, why I was being given contact information for them, but it was to protect me from the people who they had just taken me, like, out of the right. depths of addiction from
the
predators. And you've probably withdrawn by now if you've been in jail for 4 months.
It was bad.
I can't.
It was
imagine.
So bad. So being in jail, not that like, I don't know. I can laugh about this. This isn't funny, but I think today I can laugh about this. I got no sympathy right in there, and I was so sick. Like I was withdrawing in every way, shape, and form in jail, but they have less sympathy for you when you go in there and you're withdrawing from drugs.
2 weeks?
Probably at least. It was disgusting. It was like bone rattling withdrawal, and you don't get anything. Like you don't get anything to help.
Visceral or whatever they call
like,
it.
No, like take this so that like you have some comfort meds or relief. I remember I was on the top bunk. I was in a cell with another woman. You're not friends with people in jail.
No social
committee.
It's not
like the movies. No, and I remember even when I got in there, I was like, I don't belong here. Like I was that like I'm better than these people that I'm in here with, but like I was no different than anybody that was in there. But I remember this was a facility where you stayed in for at least up to a year. So I knew I would be in there for at least a year.
Wow.
And then you either get transferred elsewhere or you get released. But I was on the top bunk. And I remember I was so dope sick. I started vomiting and I like couldn't get out of the bunk. And the vomit went down onto this woman who was laying in the bunk below me. And imagine like the reaction of this woman. She literally like gripped me by the hair and pulled me off of the top bunk and was like threatening me. And I was like, could barely stand up, like so horribly dope sick, being like, please don't hurt me. Like, it was not a pretty picture.
Oh my God.
I will never forget those withdrawals. And I like, thank God for that because I never want to feel like that again. But it was not fun. And I remember being in there being like, I'm different than all of these people in here. I don't belong here. But I was no different. But yes, when I was in there, my family was working to get me into treatment, which was Carrum, Pennsylvania. They were working to find long-term treatment for me.
So how long did you spend in prison? And when you went to Carrum, PA, had you been, you were already with, your withdrawal was over, and you go into Carrum, and did you spend a year in prison?
I was in there. No, I was in there for about 4 months. And I remember I had a video court hearing with a judge who was like, you're going to go to treatment. You're going to be court ordered to treatment. So maybe it was like month five of being in there that they then gave me a date by which I would be released. But it was like direct court order to treatment. So it was like, you can either stay here or you can go to treatment. So the day that
I know.
And this was at a time in the world where addiction was starting to be looked at a little bit differently, where it was looked less at like punishment and jail, but treatment, right? The options of judges, if they believed in treatment, to grant people court ordered
drug court and wow. stuff like that. Yeah.
So it all depended on the judge. So thank God I had a judge who believed in recovery and treatment. But when I left, the day I got released, I remember I was in like a Philadelphia sheriff's van. They kind of look like the white vans from Renaissance that you're driven in when you're right, a patient. Right. And I was handcuffed handcuffed here and on my ankles with all the other six people who were being released that day to go to treatment centers. And we were in Philadelphia and I was the first one to get dropped off in Caron, Pennsylvania, which is on the opposite side of the state that Philadelphia is in, and it's in the middle of nowhere. So I remember being thrown into a van, handcuffed, and being like, where are they taking me? And I literally remember, because I was the first one being dropped off, the other inmates that were in that van, they were like, oh, you're going to the fancy rehab. Because again,
You were fancy.
I was a privileged, that was like when I kept being reminded of like, I am a privileged white person that's going to a nice treatment yeah. center and didn't understand that like the rest of the people in that van were probably not. They were probably going to like state run facilities. So I didn't want to get sober. Like, I think I was like, thank God I don't have to stay in jail and certainly not go back to the streets. But I wasn't the like, I want to be sober and I never want to use drugs again. Like, I didn't want that. I just didn't want to be back where I was. I was like, I'll go to treatment for 30 days. Maybe my family will let me move home with them and then I can go back to using. Like, I think what I wanted was to be clean long enough where I wasn't dope sick, right? And not in trouble and off of the streets so that I could go back out there and control my drug use. Like, that's literally what I believe
very logical.
Was going to happen. So logical, right? Right? Of like, I can be clean and I can go different. Back out and it'll be different this time.
Right.
When I first went there, I was like, I don't belong here with any of these people. Like, how is this place going to help me? Mm-hmm. Angry at my family of like, how could they do this to me? I was not in a grateful place of like, thank God I am alive and safe and people care about me enough to put me in treatment.
So yeah. How long were you at Caron?
So I thought I was going to be there for 30 days. when I was there, I was so not used to living in like the normalcy of life that it like kind of scared me, right? Of like having clean clothes and interacting with people. Like I was kind of shell-shocked of like, it was the opposite of what I had just been in. So I didn't understand how to like be a normal person with other people. I didn't trust anybody that was like, we want to help you. I was like, I can't trust you. Stay away from me. I thought I was going for 30 days. And on day 29, I remember my counselor was like, well, you have a session with me and your parents are going to be on the screen, right? Like the WebEx screen or whatever it's called. And I thought that they were going to tell me like, oh, we're picking you up tomorrow. It was my mom and my dad. And then some other person who I then found out was an admissions specialist in Florida for Renaissance. And they were like, you're going to go to Caron Renaissance in Florida. And I was like, what are you talking about? So they were telling me like, my choice was either I immediately get out of Caron, Pennsylvania, and I go back to jail, or you can go to long-term extended treatment in Florida. And I didn't want to go, but I also didn't want to go back to jail. So I was like, great, I'll go. So the next day I had an officer escort me to the Philadelphia airport because to them I was a flight risk, to bring me to the airport and watch me get on the plane to go to Florida. And then I got shipped to Renaissance, right? So there were people in PA that like weren't there the next day. And I'm like, where's so-and-so, right? Like, where's Sally or where's Susie? And they're like, oh, they got shipped off to Florida. So then I was like, oh my God, I'm getting shipped off to Florida. Like it seemed like this Renaissance was like made to seem like, oh, if you get sent there, like you must be like a bad kid if you're getting shipped off to Florida. Again, I was angry of like, why are they doing this to me? And thinking like,
how dare they?
How dare they? And like, I'm clean now. I just was in treatment for 30 days and like, I'm better. As that's what like, I was trying to convince myself and sell everybody else in this narrative of like, I don't need more treatment.
So you go to Florida and you go to the Karen Renaissance program in Delray Beach, Florida.
Yes.
And does there come a time where you go from being angry and I don't belong here and why are they doing this to me to holy shit, there's another life out there for me.
Yeah.
How long did that take?
It took a while. So I think I was there for like 9 months, right? I thought I was going for 3. I was there for 9. I needed it. I needed longer, but
like a gestation period.
Yeah.
It was like a failure. They were teaching you how to live.
They were teaching me how to live, which I clearly had no idea how to do.
Right. Supermarket shopping. I'm sure you hadn't done that for like 8 years.
Yeah. Yes. It probably was, I don't know, maybe 5 months of being there.
Wow.
When I was like, maybe my life can be worth living. But like scared the crap out of me because like I also didn't understand what that meant. But I think it was when I started to connect with like a sponsor and like the therapy helped me, don't get me wrong. But that wasn't the thing that I was like, the white lights went off for me because I didn't trust the clinical team. I didn't trust anybody. And I was like, they don't understand me. I was like this big victim of like, you don't know what it was like for me.
Right.
They helped me. But I think what helped me the most is that the clinical team was like, you have to go to meetings. You have to have a sponsor. You have to get off property. So it was when I realized like, okay, that I don't have a choice. Like I have to do this stuff. That then I connected with other women in recovery that was like, wait, their life is like a normal life and they're happy. And maybe like I can have that. So it took a couple months, but,
And did treatment or would you say 12-step recovery kind of help you deal with the feelings of guilt and shame, or was it kind of a combo of both?
It was probably both. I think where clinically the therapist challenged me to be confronted with things that I had a lot of shame around, I still had such shame-based thinking that like when I would look my therapist in the eye and talk about trauma or things that I had done in my brain, I'm like, she's judging me. She doesn't like me. Like she thinks I'm the scum of the earth, even though she didn't say that to me, right? Or treat me that way. But telling another woman who was in the rooms that, I didn't feel judged by them.
So what did early recovery look like?
So early recovery, I was like, poured myself into like went to meetings every single day, worked the steps. Eventually, when I finished the steps, was sponsoring women, right? Like my sponsor was kind of, I remember when I was like, will you be my sponsor? She didn't say yes right away. And I was like, you have to say yes to me. Like I just put myself out there to ask you and I was scared to be my sponsor. And I think she was like, are you willing to go to any length? And I was like, what? Like, and I didn't even know what that meant at the time. Cause like I was newly in recovery and I didn't understand the 12 steps and I didn't like give her a straight answer. And she was like, well, think about it. And then I want you to call me in like 8 days. And I was like, this girl just like, didn't tell me that she would be my sponsor. She was like making me work for it. So I like did what she said. I like thought about it. I called her 8 days later. And I think she was like, well, what like makes you think that you want this? And she just wanted to see if I would follow through with like what I said I would follow through with and call her. So she really taught me like how to get outside of myself. Like, Allie, it's not about you. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I went to speak at a meeting and I called her. I was like, her name is Lucy. And I was like, I'm so nervous. Like, what if like I say the wrong thing or I sound nervous? And she was like, how selfish are you? Like, it's about people in that room. No one is going to be thinking about you as the speaker. And like, here you are before the meeting, thinking about like what it's going to be like for you. So she was a very like a woman that was not scared to challenge me, and I needed her in my life. And she really taught me like, get outside of yourself. Like, addiction leaves us selfish, right? We need to be other centered and get outside of ourselves and give back to other people. So
yeah,
thank God for that and for her, because otherwise, like, I was just, I was thinking all about me. But yes, my early recovery was very much like invested in helping other women, wanting to help other women, like actually like being like, wait, like I get what this person feels like, or like I used to be in early recovery, or I was in treatment and I can like relate to these people. So I don't even know, like early recovery. Something clicked for me. But I remember sitting in meetings when you would see people pick up like 6 months or 9 months or a year or 5 years. And I'm like, I could never have that. Or like, didn't believe people that were up there being like, you can have your life beyond your wildest dreams. And I was like, these people are full of shit. Yeah. Like, so even though like something changed, I still don't think that I believed like this is a way of life that can be for the rest of my life. So as much as I wanted it, I think that I still was like, didn't understand exactly what that meant. But I just kept listening to what other people in the program told me to do, even if I didn't, you know, want to take suggestions.
Yeah.
And, about 2 years after treatment, I then interviewed at Renaissance, Karen Renaissance, where I went, right? The same place that I got sober at,
interviewed for a job,
as a counselor assistant. And I don't even think I like wanted to work in treatment, but they were like, we're hiring CAs, you should apply. And I was like, okay. But I worked there as a counselor assistant. And I remember they were like, if you're going to work here because of conflict of interest, like, are you ready to stop sponsoring some of the patients that you currently sponsor, or like change up the meetings you go to? And I wasn't sure that I was okay with giving that up at first. But what it forced me to do in a good way was like branch out to sponsor other women or go to different meetings. Right. So that was a hard choice for me to make, because those are the things that kept me sober. But then I was like, if I'm going to work in this field, like I had to maintain boundaries with, you know, clients that went there if I worked there.
No, but thank you so much for coming. Thank you guys for listening. Please like, subscribe.
Smack the bell.
Subscribe.
Smack the bell.
I guess. And comment. Tell us. Tell us what you want. Tell us how we're doing.